Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from the first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program online at carthage.edu/aspire. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. During COVID-19, performing arts have seemingly ground to a halt when it comes to at least live performance, to audiences gathering in auditoriums and theaters to see actors on the stage or musicians on the stage. That is something that seems like a luxury just out of our reach. But fortunately, there are intrepid companies that are an exception to the prevailing rule and that are trying to make music and or make theater, even within the constrictions and restrictions of COVID-19. And the Fleeing Artists Theater of Kenosha are making theater this weekend. In fact, they are performing William Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing in actually four performances, all delivered virtually, and by two different casts. And we're going to be speaking with the director of this, Alex Matowski, and with three of the actors who are part of this weekend's performances. Kayla Bingen, who is a recent Carthage grad, and she is part of the so-called Rose cast, and then Kayla Ryan Walsh and Gloria Huang, who are part of the Globe cast. And Alex, in a moment, will explain that distinction, and we will get to know all of them. But these performances of Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing will be this Friday and Saturday, 6 p.m. local time, and then there are 2 p.m. performances Saturday and Sunday, and each cast has an opportunity to present two performances of this Shakespeare classic. First of all, we welcome all of you to the Morning Show, and thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us, Greg.
Glad to be able to have what I think will be an exciting conversation. So, Alex, let's first of all get the out of the way this matter of the two casts, and then we'll dig a little more into the details of how all of this has been put together. But explain the really happy circumstances under which you decided to do this play with two different casts.
Sure. Well, when we put out the audition call for Much Ado About Nothing, this was our first time having auditions in the era of COVID-19. So we had no idea whether we would have a tremendous turnout or a tiny turnout. We didn't know everyone's availability. Fortuitously, the word of our auditions spread out beyond the borders of Wisconsin and even the Midwest and reached the East Coast, the West Coast, Canada, South America, everywhere across the planet. We had a few auditionees from England. And so we had over 200 auditionees or around 200 auditionees send in their stuff. And there was so much talent that a cast size of 10 actors playing the roles just didn't seem like it would do justice to what happened. And so we decided to have one Midwest-based cast and one international cast.
Very good. So explain the name Rose. The Midwest cast is your Rose cast. Can you explain?
Right. Sure. Well, when describing the cast as the Midwest cast and the international cast, that just seems to put a little too much favor in one cast over the other. Mm-hmm. So both casts are named after two theaters which Shakespeare had worked at. Of course, the famous Globe Theater and then the Rose Theater, which was a theater that Shakespeare had worked on in his early days, even before the theater.
Excellent. So you obviously were anxious to continue doing theater somehow, even within the restrictions of COVID-19. What drew you to this particular play? Was there anything about it where you thought it would lend itself especially well to this rather unorthodox format?
Well, truthfully, this we had picked two plays and for the summer before everything hit, Much Ado About Nothing and Oedipus Rex. Once COVID-19 ran rampant and we realized it was here to stay, our board thought about whether, would it be good to do this play? Should we do something else? And we thought, you know, it would be wonderful to do a comedy, a witty comedy with some dramatic elements as a bit of a distraction in this era.
Hmm. So this was already on the boards and you decided to stick with it. And yep. Even though it was going to be in this particular format. Very good. So I want to hear from the three actors, first of all, about the audition process. And I want to talk in a moment with the two members of the Globe cast. But first, let's talk with Kayla Bingen, who is more of a local talent and would be part of the Rose cast. And I think you have been part of other things that this theater company has done, correct?
That's correct. This last December, I assistant directed their production of A Christmas Carol. And also, earlier this spring, I was cast in their production of God of Carnage, which was unable to happen and has been indefinitely postponed due to COVID-19.
Unfortunately. So had you, I assume you had never had to do an audition in virtual format before. What was that like? How did it, in what ways did it feel like a very different undertaking from a more normal, we're both in the same room kind of audition?
Sure. Yeah, it was interesting interacting with actors, not physically, even if you're not actually touching an actor, being in the same space as them creates a tangible energy that helps fuel the drama of any scene. And basically creating that in this little box with your eyes and, you know, from, you know, your collarbone up has been quite the undertaking and an interesting way to use your space in creative ways too, especially in that audition process to help you stand out, to make sure you're connecting with those people you're auditioning with and making connections to what's happening in the script as well.
Right. Kayla and Gloria, let's hear from you. You would be two people who are from far-flung areas far away. Let's see, Kayla Ryan Walsh from Bend, Oregon, and Gloria Huang actually from Vancouver, Canada. So first of all, what prompted you to want to audition for what I assume is a theater company you'd never heard of before this? Gloria, let's start with you.
Well, I just graduated from NYU, and I miss acting. And then one day, I saw from my email from backstage, there was like Much Ado About Nothing. And I love Shakespeare and classical work. So I just immediately decided to audition for it.
Just because it was something going on and the moment when everything seemed so dormant.
Yeah.
Very good. How about you, Kayla Ryan Walsh?
Absolutely. It's funny, you realize when you have a lot of time, how much time you really have in your life. And I felt that there was kind of a hole missing, especially in Shakespeare, being a musical theater performer primarily. And interestingly enough, Much Ado was the last show I did at college quite a few years ago. And frankly, I wanted to revisit it with a different set of eyes if the company would be willing to explore me in their production. So frankly, I kind of wanted to, I think there's a lot of value in exploring shows you've already done from previous years and revisiting them with new eyes and with a different character. So I was kind of guns blazing with the idea of playing Beatrice, if that was of interest to the company. And it turned out in my favor, and it's been very, very cathartic and inspirational on many fronts, for sure.
For those of you just joining us, we have with us on the morning show four people involved with the Fleeing Artists Theater's production of Shakespeare, Much Ado About Nothing, a virtual production, needless to say, four performances that are going to be presented this coming weekend. The director, Alex Matowski, is with us, along with Kayla Bingen, Kayla Ryan Walsh, and Gloria Huang. Kayla Bingen is in the Rose cast, the Midwestern cast. Kayla Ryan Walsh and Gloria Huang are in the so-called Globe cast, which features people, actors from outside of the Midwest. Alex, before we dig into kind of what this process has been like to put this together, maybe you could summarize for our listeners, those who aren't acquainted with Shakespeare's delightful play, What Much Ado About Nothing is about. I think it's about more than nothing.
Oh, yeah. It's Much Ado About It. Yes. So it's one of Shakespeare's wittiest comedies. It's one of his, in my opinion, my humble opinion, his funniest comedies. Without giving too much away, one of the most famous couples in all of theater and film is in the play, Benedict and Beatrice. They are feuding lovers who cannot stand one another in the beginning of the play, but because their friends know how perfect they are for one another, they are tricked into believing that the other loves the other, they love one another, and by play's end, fall in love. All while this is going on, other younger lovers, a young soldier and a daughter of a wealthy governor, fall in love and are set to be wedded, but an evil villain named Don John plots against the two of them and turns them against one another, or Claudio against Hero, I should say.
If I recall, this is a play that comes right in the heart of Shakespeare's career. I mean, he's at the peak of his powers, and it sounds like you feel like this is Shakespeare at his very best.
Oh, yes. So this was written in the during his peak years, 1598. This is around the time he's writing Hamlet and his beautiful dramas. It's the time he's perfected his comic writings. The Benedict and Beatrice pairing, the feuding lovers, are a template which have been repeated throughout the years in pop culture, in romantic comedies. Han Solo and Princess Leia, I would argue, are today's modern versions of Benedict and Beatrice, if that can put a nice little visual aid to that.
Interesting. So before we go back to our actors, Alex, explain what you plotted out in terms of once you had cast this, what you plotted out in terms of a rehearsal schedule. And is it a rehearsal schedule that would very much resemble what the rehearsal schedule would have been if this had been a standard production on a standard stage? Or were there things you had to do very differently in terms of putting the rehearsal process together?
I would say it was a combination of everything. In the beginning, I wanted to try to create as comfortable and as inviting a space as possible. And so I tried to follow a 4-day a week, 3-hour a day rehearsal schedule, which is fairly standard for at least what we do. But with two casts, that meant spreading that out throughout the week. And so there might be some afternoon rehearsals, there might be some late evening rehearsals. It was a challenge, particularly with the Globecast, coordinating time zones and whatnot. You take those types of things for granted. Oh, everyone, it must be 6 to 9 everywhere. No, in Brazil, it's 8 to 11. Mm. That's pretty late. Yeah. On the West Coast, it's from 4 to 7, which is pretty early.
Interesting.
Yeah, and it's been a wonderful process exploring the new venue of that is Zoom, that is the virtual space, and figuring out how best to convey this old language in a new way.
Right. About the Midwest cast, Kayla, of course, lives pretty much right here in the Kenosha area, I believe, right, Kayla? How far flung are we talking about in terms of her castmates?
Let's see. The Midwest cast is fairly centric to southern Wisconsin and northern Illinois. It's essentially the typical people who would audition for our shows. And then the Globecast is everywhere from East Coast, West Coast, Canada, Brazil. It's everywhere on the American continents.
So Kayla's not acting with anyone from Fargo, North Dakota, then?
No.
Okay.
Or St. Louis, or Ohio, or anywhere.
Very good.
Yeah.
So Kayla, you know most of the people in this cast and have worked with many of them before, is that right?
A handful of them I've either worked with before or crossed paths with in the Milwaukee theater scene. I'm playing alongside my husband, which is great.
Oh yeah, very good. Now I suspect Gloria and Kayla Ryan Walsh, that your situation is very different, that you, I assume, are acting with a cast that are complete strangers to you. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting because in school I'm so used to like acting with people who are my age. So it's very refreshing to have people who are completely different and from all over the world. Yeah.
So not just your own peers, but
a
nice wide range of talent. Let's talk for a moment about what this feels like to be doing what you've done for many years, but in this very different kind of format. First of all, is this the first time any of you have actually performed in a production that is virtual, that is being done on a screen versus on a stage?
It is, for me at least. It's a whole new medium. You know, you kind of take for granted how far along we are technologically to make this happen. And so it's interesting exploring acting through a box, literally, and finding out where your focus needs to be so that the audience can feel as if they are in a theater experiencing something in front of them live. So that's been a wonderful challenge, and also has been almost even more exhausting because you find that you're giving yourself laser focus, straightforward, and desperately wanting to connect and show the audience that you're having the same kind of experience as an actor, just with a screen, and hopefully giving the audience permission to use their own imagination to really envision Benedict is across the way from Beatrice, and Dogberry and Verges are right next to each other. It's really kind of brilliant, and I don't foresee that going away anytime soon, quite frankly.
In other words, you see a future for this kind of theater production, even after COVID recedes to the point where it's no longer necessary. You think this is a viable art form in and of itself, in a sense?
I do, in the sense of there's a sense of creativity that can be explored that may not always transfer as well on stage. I think that, especially within comedies, that there are so many approaches that you can have with a piece, but especially with Much Ado, that has been so great that Alex has encouraged us with, is to like go bigger than you would necessarily go, and then from there we'll see how that transfers from an audience perspective. And I think in that there's a lot of creativity for directors and artists to explore different methods of tactics of getting what they want and getting their point across.
I see what you're saying, because typically you would be on a stage performing for people who are a fair distance away, and so what might work on the stage in terms of a flamboyant gesture might really work and seem overdone in the close proximity of the screen. And on the other hand, something very subtle might not read whatsoever if you're on the stage to an audience. I can see how you maybe have a different array of choices to make in this kind of format. Interesting. Gloria, what has this experience been like for you in terms of how different this feels from the other kind of acting that you have done?
Yeah, our final production, we did Coriolanus, and it was also through Zoom, but
this was at school?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, but unlike this production, Coriolanus was pre-filmed, so it was actually more like a movie, and it was then edited and then presented. This is like, there's something about, because on Zoom, you can't rely on eye contact, which usually if you're in person, it's so important. So you really have to listen to each other and like use Shakespeare's words to get through it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like you have a whole different palette of paints at your disposal, or different tools, a different toolbox than normal. Kayla Bingen, what about you? You've already touched when you described the audition, how this was a very different experience. Now, as you approach the performances, how does this feel different from the other acting you've done?
Yeah, besides, you know, a few monologues over Zoom, this is my first full Zoom performance. It's interesting to be doing it live. I think you're going to feel nervous when you know you have an audience, but you can't really see them and you're not going to hear their reaction. So I know that they're there. I'm going to trust that they are just laughing like mad. and you know, use that to inspire me. But yeah, it's going to be interesting not having that same feedback. And like Gloria said, you pull that energy then from your fellow actors. The way that you listen to each other, you gain energy and build momentum as a group. And if you can't pull it from your audience, then you must just rely entirely on each other to do it.
Wow. So yeah, you are dependent on each other for that reason, in a way that is probably not to that same extent necessary in a normal production. Alex, explain what people will see in particular on the screen with the various little squares of Hollywood squares, or the laughing conversation, or whatever we want to,
or the Brady Bunch, right?
Brady Bunch opening credits. Do you have control over where those squares are, and if given actors are positioned next to one another, or is all of that out the window, and does this become a medium that just can't depend on any of those sorts of visuals?
One of the points of focus we focused on in rehearsal was figuring out how best to convey and portray everyone on the screen. And I cannot directly control where everyone is, but by figuring out, oh, entrance order, someone who turns their screen on first will appear next to the person who turns it on second. And then with six people on, that means two rows of three, and eight people, two rows of four, etc. We can figure out, oh, okay, if I were arranging the scene in real life, the friar would be standing next to Claudio and Hero in the marriage. Okay, you three, turn yours on after these two, during this part right here. Zoom is basically a perfect blend of film acting with live acting, if that makes sense. Just the box filming, zooming in, honing in on those micro details of the face, while also creating a live experience that creates that energy, that palpable feeling between your fellow actors.
Will anyone be in costumes, and will anyone be holding props?
Yes and yes. We won't be going Renaissance with it. We won't be going with a lavish $1,000 production that we totally would have done if not for Zoom. I'm not just making that up. Yeah. But we will have props. We will have a semblance of costumes. And we'll also poke fun at the medium. There's only so much you can do with Zoom. And it's a comedy. We're going to have fun with it.
Sounds like a good idea. Actors, I imagine that one of the sad things about this is that you don't get to run off to Denny's after rehearsal the way the typical theatrical cast does. But have you had any opportunity to, in a sense, socially connect, albeit only virtually? Or was that going to be maybe down the road?
I think it's just been fun doing scene work with these individuals and feeling like we are closer than ever in a certain way, feeling so close with this camera and feeling like we have to work so hard to connect with each other. No real socializing yet, but maybe down the road we're going to have an awesome cast party when things are a little bit safer.
Things are normal. Kayla and Gloria, what kind of connection do you feel with your castmates?
Oh, these goofballs, you can't get enough of them. But like, we keep on joking, we should hop on Zoom and have a happy hour. And I think that's going to be our reality for a little bit as of now. And unfortunately, with the Globecast, all of us are so spread out. Hopefully our paths will cross. But I think we may just live through the screen with one another at this time.
Well, better than nothing. Gloria, final thought?
Yeah, because, you know, everyone is so far apart. So we try to get to know each other during our breaks, so we're just chatting what's going on with everyone. But yeah, hopefully one day, you know, some of us can meet up, if not all.
I hope so too. Yeah. In the meantime, we can all see the fruits of your labor this weekend with these four performances of Much Ado About Nothing. Alex, how do people connect with the Zoom meeting in order to watch this?
The best way is through Facebook. So we'll be going through a Zoom webinar, which allows 100 people to tune in and watch. On our Facebook page and on our Facebook event, there's a link you can click, or we'll be streaming on our Facebook page at the times mentioned. It's easy to sign in, but the sooner you get there, the more likely you'll be able to watch, because 100 people's not a lot. So we'll have audiences from all over the world. It's fascinating.
Yeah, fascinating and exciting. Alex Matowski, Kayla Bingen, Kayla Ryan Walsh, Gloria Huang, thank you for being part of the morning show, and best wishes with your performances this coming weekend. And we hope all of you can be back on a standard stage sometime soon. Best wishes to all of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
And here is music of Eric Wolfgang Korngold from his incidental music to Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing. Part two of the morning show coming up in just a moment. The time is 8:37. You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD, and here is part two. And for this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, we are looking back to a both famous and infamous film and the novel which inspired it, Valley of the Dolls. Stephen Rebello, who has written extensively about matters related to Hollywood and a screenwriter himself, has written a book that has just come out called Dolls, 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 Deep Inside Valley of the Dolls, the most beloved bad book and movie of all time. And critics are pretty much unanimous in panning both Jacqueline Suzanne's novel and the film which it inspired. But that does not mean that there isn't a really fascinating story tied up in both the novel and the film. And Stephen Rebello explores all of that in his fascinating new book. Stephen Rebello, we welcome you to the morning show.
I am thrilled to be welcomed. Nice to be with you.
I wonder if we could have you compare the experience of writing this book versus an earlier book in which you take us behind the scenes of what many people regard as an absolute masterpiece, Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. What was it like to write, in a sense, a similar book, but about a very, very different kind of film, which, unlike Psycho, is pretty much universally derided? Did it feel like a completely different undertaking for you because of that difference between the two films themselves?
It's a great question. I think that the difference would only be marked if I had sort of a totally different attitude toward the process. So the process was quite the same, and I approached it the same. I needed to talk with people who were there. I needed to do, deep research into archives around the country where, studio records were and all of that. I needed to talk with people who were not necessarily involved in the film, but who were in Hollywood at the time and could speak to kind of the mores and the morals, or lack thereof. And So the digging and the exploration were quite similar. I was very kind of, you know, weirdly sure about it. You know, oddly, when I was doing Psycho, believe it or not, people were asking me, why would someone as serious and, you know, as interested in this as you are pick Psycho as opposed to some of Hitchcock's much more important, better movies? So that's a really interesting indication of how cultural tides can ebb and flow, that, you know, Psycho at the time was not considered the masterpiece that I thought it was, and certainly I think there's a lot of evidence to support the fact that it is with critics around the world and scholars. With Valley of the Dolls, believe me, I'm not making any claim that this was a masterpiece, but I wanted to, well, first of all, I wanted to have fun, and I wanted to give readers a sense of fun and my joy in telling the story. But also, I wanted to point out that nobody sets out to make a bad movie. The pains of the creative process, the casting that goes on, the agonizing decisions, they're quite similar. It's just the outcome is so different. But I wanted to have fun with this. I want to tell you that the more I dug into the personal lives and the what was going on in the lives of the people who were making the movie at the time, it was fun, but it was also revealing. We forget sometimes, or I'll say I forget sometimes, that we're all human and people have jobs, but they also have personal lives that are sometimes, let's say, challenging, or glorious, troubled. And that was the case on both of the movies, but especially on Valley of the Dolls.
Right. And it's interesting.
So much discord.
Yeah. And of course, it's interesting. There were plenty of talented people involved in that film. So it's not that you had a bunch of idiots making the film, but somehow their collective efforts didn't result in something of very high quality, which we can get to in just a moment. Can we have you talk briefly about the original novel, which was Jacqueline Suzanne's first novel? And I have not ever read that book. I'm not sure I ever will. But I wonder if you could just say a word about why that novel is, although despite the fact that it was a runaway bestseller, why it attracted such negative criticism. I mean, criticism nearly equal to the criticism that's lodged against the film. I mean, in a sense, what would you say is wrong with the novel?
Well, it's pretty poorly written. It's abysmal in some ways. But the thing of it is that the characters, are lived in. Jacqueline Suzanne knew about the world of show business. But more importantly, she knew about what happens to women when they reach a certain age, how they are devalued, not listened to, cast aside. She knew about loneliness. She knew about failed careers. And she also knew that pill popping was not just something that other people did, but it was something that, began in the 60s, really, and was something that was, pretty prevalent among people who were considered beautiful, successful, talented, on their way up, should be happy, but weren't. And how different is that from the opioid crisis that we're going through right now? So there's a lot of vitality to the novel, and it's a lot of vulgarity, but there's a lot of vulgar vitality to it that keeps people coming back to it.
Mm.
You should read it. It's worth it.
Mm. When we get to the film, we're talking, of course, about an array of significant actors, and one of the things your book explores is the even longer list of even more significant actors and actresses who were at least at some point in the process considered for the cast, and that in and of itself is an interesting matter. But I think we should spend a moment talking about the legendary Judy Garland, who was cast in Valley of the Dolls and then fired from it. Tell us, first of all, where Judy Garland was in her career at the point when she was signed to appear in Valley of the Dolls? And what did this project mean for her in the moment, even though it ended very badly for her?
It did. Well, look, she had not made a film in 5 years. That was because Hollywood considered her a risk. Too many missed days, too much time spent in retake after retake. She was just considered unreliable, but she had a big name. And the fact that Valley of the Dolls was about pill taking and, you know, some women at the end of their journey or at the end of their ropes, it seemed like a brilliant casting. And it kind of was. It certainly got a great, great deal of publicity. But she was a mess. She was in a really difficult time in her life. She'd had her most recent breakup and divorce. She had just been evicted from her home. She lost her home. She was bankrupt. She was the sole support of her children. And she really needed the money. And she needed to and hoped to prove to Hollywood that she still had it. She still could sing, she could act, and she wanted to show that she was employable. And I think she also wanted to show that she was a good sport, because so much of the novel and its reputation had to do with the who guessing game of who these characters in the novel really were. And Judy Garland was one of those characters. A veiled version of Judy Garland is one of those characters in the book. And it didn't go well from the first moment that she walked onto the set. And it only went more south as the days progressed. She wasn't treated well. She was actually treated very poorly. It almost seemed like the director wanted to provoke her so that he could hire the woman he really wanted to play the role from the beginning, I think, which was Susan Hayward. And a very fragile, fractured, troubled, insecure, big star arrived on the set and was treated as though she were nothing. And she crumbled. She crumbled before everyone's eyes, and it was tragic.
Yeah. I think that's the perfect word for it. Yes. And, of course, Susan Hayward comes in to take her place. In some respects, every bit as troubled at that point in time is Oscar winner Patty Duke, who is one of the leads in the film. And it turns out that this comes at a point when Patty Duke was beginning to battle the effects of bipolar disorder. And she somehow hangs on and manages to not to be fired from the film, but she is one reason why the process of making this film was so difficult. And certainly for as gifted as Patty Duke is, this is not much of a performance that she delivers, at least in my opinion. How would you assess Patty Duke's presence in this film?
Well, on the set, I would assess her presence as quicksand. She was she and the director were completely at odds, and lots of very salty language flew back and forth. They just despised each other, and it was her belief that she needed to become a grown-up on screen and off screen. And she thought, and many people thought, this was going to be a second Oscar for her. But she didn't have the script. And she was, as you say, going through a very, very difficult time where she had mood swings that were terrifying. She had been institutionalized and was in and out of treatment. She had multiple addictions. There was a troubled marriage going on. I mean, it was a recipe for disaster, but she started the movie, as many of the people who made Valley of the Dolls started the movie, wanting to do a really good job, hoping for the best, and being ground down by a terrible director, a terrible script, and you know, personal difficulties, interpersonal difficulties, bad chemistry that was going on, bad juju that was going on the set. The vibe was very bad for most of the people. And so it wasn't going well at all.
Right.
It got worse and worse.
I feel like my most vivid memory of watching this film is the moment that in which her character of Neely kind of has this big breakout moment on a television program, and you know, in a sense, her own stardom is launched. I remember watching this film and thinking, really? I mean, there is nothing about that moment in terms of what Patty Duke is doing that makes it seem like, you know, a star is born. I mean, we're supposed to believe that in this moment her character is about to take off in with superstardom on the strength of this singing career performance she delivers on a TV show, and it just falls flat. It just looks strange. And like so many parts of this film, there are these moments that just don't feel authentic. It feels so kind of histrionic and artificial and over the top in a way that, I mean, at least critics did not find persuasive. Of course, plenty of people went to this movie, so it persuaded at least some people, I guess.
The easily persuaded. The whole thing is very shrill. She does not deliver as, you know, the role needed a young Streisand, a young Liza Minnelli, you know, a meteor, somebody that just grabbed you by the throat. And those women were looked at for that role. The role was offered to Barbara Streisand. But, you know, Patty Duke was not a singer. She's dubbed in the movie. She doesn't know how to move like a singer. And there's nothing, as you say, there's nothing about her that just, you know, has just brilliant charisma. And it's completely misguided. Almost so many of the aspects of the movie are, you know, miss the target because of wrong casting choices, wrong acting choices, wrong costume choices. Shall we go on?
Yeah, right. We certainly could. Actually, and one thing we've not yet talked about is the decision that was made to alter the ending of the novel, which is actually even darker than what ends up being the end of the film. And this is one reason why sci-fi writer Harlan Ellison, you know, ends up withdrawing from the film, if I remember correctly, because of this drastic ending, change in the ending that was being insisted upon. What do you make of that decision to change the ending of Jacqueline Suzanne's novel for the film?
It outraged a lot of the readers who wanted the character of Anne Wells to, you know, make a decision to break away from that world, break away from show business, break away from this ridiculously drawn, terrible male character that she's so fascinated by, but no one else is. So, you know, Jackie Suzanne hated the ending, and feminists hated the ending. Well, feminists hated all of it for many reasons. But it's a sellout because the ending of the film suggests that these two characters who we never really want to see again at all, but we certainly don't care if they're together again. It sort of leaves it open that perhaps, you know, kind of Rhett and Scarlett might get together again, but maybe won't. So, you know, it's just one of a series of, you know, very unfortunate decisions made by people who probably had no right to be making the movie in the first place.
What would you say would be one or two praiseworthy aspects of the film? I mean, for instance, are there one or two performances that are commendable in any way, or what reason would there be for somebody to take the time to watch Valley of the Dolls?
or by extension to write this book or to read this book. It's a very fair question. You know, is Patty Duke good in the movie? No, she's quite terrible. Does that mean she's unwatchable? No, it's a fascinating misfire. how could someone so talented as she make so many wrong choices and look so ridiculous and look so awkward? So there's sort of a grim there's a grim pleasure in seeing that humans can be fallible, that even truly talented people can make really terrible choices. You do watch her. Susan Hayward is in the movie, and she was, not only a big star, Oscar winner and all that, but she certainly had a big screen presence and a biting sort of bitchy, in-your-face presence in movies. In this movie, she has something, but again, knowing now that she was probably beginning to show the effects of brain cancer, her movements, her line readings, her, you know, over-the-topness, while it's compelling and it's certainly watchable, it isn't good, but it may even have some, it may be explicable in terms of the difficulties she was going through at the time with her health and the fact that she was a recent widow. Another thing about the movie, it's short. So that's a virtue. if you're unhappy with it, you don't need to keep watching. But people watch this movie again and again and again and again. I shudder to think of the time that some people told me they have spent watching it. But I think it's fascinating that with material that in another era, say directed by a Douglas Sirk or a Vincent Minnelli or a George Cukor, with a really good script, I mean, their intention was to make an all about Eve kind of a bitchy, witty, inside show business movie. And look at how far they fell in their intentions. But that doesn't mean it isn't worth watching and it isn't worth seeing again and again.
Well, and I'm really glad you wrote this book about it too, because it's a fascinating story of why a film fails. And that's a story that that's the kind of story that doesn't get told enough, because often those are the most interesting stories. I think you've done something really, really intriguing here with your book, Dolls, 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 Deep Inside, Valley of the Dolls, the most beloved bad book and movie of all time, published by Penguin Books, the author Stephen Rebello. Stephen Rebello, I really enjoyed our conversation, and I enjoyed your book, and I'm glad we could talk about it today on The Morning Show. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, my interview with John Feerick, former dean of the Fordham Law School, and one of the principal authors of the 25th Amendment of our Constitution. The 25th Amendment is what covers those situations in which a president, for one reason or another, is disabled, and a vice president must step into his or her place. John Feerick's memoir about his long career in law is titled That Further Shore. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program